Tonight, Dr. John DeSalvo decodes the pyramids. And also we'll talk about the Shroud of Turin. You know, the Shroud is a piece of ancient linen cloth that measures about 14 feet long by 3.5 feet wide. And on this very cloth is a faint imprint of a human being who appears to have been crucified. Legend has it, of course, that the Shroud is actually the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. The Shroud takes its name from its present location, which is in the Cathedral of John the Baptist in Turin, Italy. So that's just one of the stories. We're going to get a quick update from John DeSalvo on that, too, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. John DeSalvo, he's the director of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association. Now, that's one of the largest pyramid research associations in the world. And its purpose, of course, is to disseminate and promote pyramid research from both traditional and alternative researchers. Its advisory board is composed of 30 prominent pyramid researchers from around the world. And he's also responsible now for disseminating the Russian and Ukrainian pyramid research to all of us around the world. John is also the executive vice president of the largest and oldest existing Shroud Research Association, the Association of Scientists and Scholars International for the Shroud of Turin. Here he is tonight on Coast to Coast. Welcome back, John. How are you?
Yeah, hi, George. It's a pleasure to be back on Coast to Coast. Likewise. Thanks for having me back on.
You have been busy, my friend. Very busy.
Yeah, I seem to get involved in almost everything that's a mystery, you know.
Hey, look, we're going to talk a lot about the pyramids tonight, but give us an update on the Shroud of Turin. What's going on there?
Sure. Well, there was, you know, some new information released a while ago about the Shroud, but most of your listeners probably know that the Shroud of Turin was radiocarbon dated back around 1988, and the three independent labs that did the test came up with a medieval date of the Shroud between 1260 and 1390 AD. So this was a blow to a lot of the researchers and people that were interested in the Shroud, because they thought, okay, well, if it's not 2,000 years old, it rules out the possibility that it's the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. Well, anyway, there's some possibilities that why the date could be off 1,300 years. And the most recent and, I think, accepted possibility is called the reweaving hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the Shroud has been handled and on exhibit, and so it would have been frayed, especially at the ends, and it's likely that it was reweaved with, you know, new fibers around the medieval times. And in fact, the area where we think it was reweaved is very close to where the sample was taken for the carbon 14 dating. And in fact, some scientists felt that if it was reweaved, you know, George, if you take like a new piece of new fiber or cloth and try to match it with an old one, you know, it's a different color.
Right, right.
So they believe that the medieval reweavers had to kind of match or dye the new fibers to match the cloth. So if that was the case, there would be known compounds that they would have used, like rose madder, gum, arabic, aluminum, etc. And actually, some researchers have claimed that they have identified these chemicals exactly in that area, you know, showing that it was dyed to try to match the old cloth. So I think that is the most likely possibility why the Shroud date could be off, because you're actually dating more recent fibers with the old cloth. I always say it really needs to be done again. Another possibility is another researcher thinks that maybe bacteria could have coated the fibers, you know, modern bacteria, which
sure.
is composed of carbon, and that would possibly throw the date off. The only problem with that theory is that it's calculated that, you know, you'd have to have over like 60% of bacteria contamination to bring the date of the cloth back to, you know, 2,000 years. So that's not as likely as the first. And then you had my very good friend Barry Schwartz on a few weeks ago
exactly.
to update on the
carbon
monoxide theory,
yep.
And which John Jackson proposed, which I know John and worked with him many years ago. I have a lot of respect for John, very, very brilliant researcher. His theory basically, and Barry covered it quite well, and I agreed with everything that Barry said, that carbon monoxide, which, you know, about one every millionth carbon monoxide molecule would have a carbon 14, but basically carbon monoxide what got infused with the cloth, thus adding more modern carbon 14. Now, how could this occur? John, one possibility that John Jackson feels is the fire of 1532. Those who follow the Shroud know at that time the Shroud was kept in Chambéry, France, in a sealed casket, and the chapel was on fire, and it was like pressure cooker conditions inside the casket.
Exactly.
And this, it's possible there's a mechanism that the carbon monoxide was infused into the cloth. I think John is looking at other possibilities, too, that atmospheric carbon monoxide, like from industry and the environment, could have gotten and contaminated the cloth, thus bringing up the carbon-14 content that's making the cloth look more, you know, modern. That, again, what's interesting about that is that is John got Professor Christopher Ramsey from the Oxford facility to test that for him. He is going to simulate some linen cloths and impregnate them with carbon monoxide, I guess, with different ways, and then Christopher Ramsey will run the carbon-14 dating to see if, you know, will it change the date. Now, unfortunately, most radiocarbon experts do not think this mechanism would change the date of the cloth. But, you know, like anything, John's approaching it very scientifically. He comes up with a hypothesis, and he's going to test that. So we'll see what happens. But my personal opinion is the reweaving hypothesis is the most logical one at this time. And, again, I do hope the Shroud will be subject to additional testing.
I do, too. Can you rule out, John, that it's a painting?
Well, I personally rule it out for several reasons. I've been involved in Shroud research for almost 30 years. Actually, next year will be my 30th year. And I've seen, you know, every type of forgery with people that try to simulate the cloth. And some of them are very interesting. You know, some have reconstructed the negativity. Some have reconstructed the three-dimensional effect, the surface phenomena. But no one painting simulation, to me, has reconstructed everything we see on the Shroud. It is so unique that even like the blood had to be on before the image. How do you do that? How do you put blood samples on a cloth and then paint the image? But one interesting thing, George, last time I was on, I mentioned the Shroud was going to be put away and not be subject to any experiments
right,
or public display to 2025. Do you remember that?
That was about 2 years ago. You were
exactly.
Right? Okay.
Well, recently I just spoke to our project director, actually this week, Paul Maloney, and he's telling me that they changed that date to 2010, that Cardinal Pallotta, the Archbishop of Turin, convinced Pope Benedict XVI to have a public exposition in 2010. Now, that is great news.
That is good news.
I'm hoping, we're not sure if it's going to be subject to any additional testing. Would samples be removed for additional carbon-14? We don't know, but I think that's just excellent news, and that's, I just heard that from Paul right off the press, and so this is, very exciting. That's only 2 years down the road.
Well, whatever it may be, John, if it indeed ends up being Christ's cloth and it was based on a burst of energy from the resurrection, what an unbelievable story that will be.
It is. You know, the other thing I wanted to maybe bring up to add a little, you asked Barry, remember, about DNA testing?
Yes.
And which is interesting. As far as I know, and I checked with Paul and others, there's really been no karyotyping of the Shroud for several reasons. You know, the genetic material would be in the white blood cells, and those disintegrate very easily, and there's really not adequate samples. But recently at the University of Texas Health Center, they did identify a kind of a broken male hormone, which would come from the Y chromosome. There's some tests that have been done, some chemical tests, but nothing really significant. And one of the other problems would be the cloth has been handled. I'm sure it has been kissed and venerated. And so, you know, you would have it contaminated with DNA from other sources. And you know, you would have to know for sure that the DNA you removed would have been from the person wrapped in the cloth. So there are some problems with the DNA testing. But again, you know, as technology, never say never, you know, George, as technology advances, we may develop greater and greater technology to do DNA and karyotyping on very minute and old samples. So, I just think it's exciting, and I hope testing is allowed in 2010. And like I said, this has been a very exciting mystery to the world.
Absolutely. John, let's move on now. We talk about the pyramids, one of my favorite subjects, of course, and I want to get your take by the end of tonight on how you think those things were constructed. But there seems to be similarities, too, of pyramids all around the planet. I find that to be fascinating. What's your take on that?
Oh, I do, too. I mean, I guess recently that has crossed my mind more, especially with some of the research will be discovering. The idea that, and maybe it's in a collective unconsciousness, or it has been planted somehow in the minds of humans, but, you know, having these pyramids all over the world, in South America, in Egypt, even in Europe and Asia, you know, even the possibility of pyramids on Mars. Is there some universal phenomena with pyramid building, you know? That really fascinates me, and I think you're right. Now, the similarities and differences, well, a lot of the most of them are tetrahedral, four-sided that we find on Earth. You know, on Mars, there's both three-sided and five-sided pyramids. But the slopes appear to be different. You know, some have, like the Great Pyramid has a slope of around 51.5 degrees. The Russian pyramids, which are modern, though, are more like 73 degrees. The South American pyramids vary lesser of a slope, so the materials kind of could be different, passageways different, but the idea of the structure, that to me the pyramid is some kind of universal geometry that is important in our culture and in our history, and I think that's why I personally got hooked on this, and I think many people have. It's just a mystery when we see something like the Great Pyramid, and we figure, it definitely was not built as a tomb for a pharaoh. I do not believe the ancient Egyptians could have built it using wooden hammer and copper chisels. It, again, opens up a big mystery.
Joe Parr was part of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, wasn't he not?
Right, right.
Tell me a little bit about his work.
Sure. Actually, Joe is one of our research directors and a fascinating individual. I sometimes refer to him as a modern-day Tesla, which he gets mad at me because he's a very, very humble and modest individual. But he's been an electronics engineer for over 40 years, and he's recently retired. But he's done pyramid research for at least 30 years on the side as a hobby. I wouldn't even call it a hobby. I'd call it a vocation. I mean, he's just an incredible researcher.
Did he invite the gamma ray transducer.
He invented this device for actually measuring levels of radioactivity around different types of alternative energy sources. I'm always impressed that he was involved in 8 government projects spanning the globe. So, I mean, he's a man that would be trusted and involved in the highest level of government research. He's also one of the few people to spend 2 entire nights on top of the Great Pyramid on 2 different occasions, running electrical, magnetic, and radioactive measurements. And and that's I think what led Joe to pyramid research. You know, he had this incredible technical background. He looked at the pyramid, he took some measurements, and he thought something unusual is going on here. And so that is what led him, I guess, into researching the pyramid for 30 years. I've been fortunate to have hooked up with Joe and to be able to I kind of say his spokesperson or releasing his research because it is just incredible. And I appreciate you letting me give you a little bit about his background. Oh, he also has a JD degree, a law degree. I mean, if when you hear about his research and what he has done, the first thing you would want to know is, who is this guy? What is his background? Because it is such an incredible amount of discoveries.
What planet did he come from, right?
Exactly, So I'm very humbled that we have such great researchers in our association, and Pat Flanagan also, who again has been one of my idols for years. I remember reading his book in '73 on pyramid power, and I was honored that he wrote the foreword to my new book. But Pat Flanagan again, Stephen Mailer, who's been on your show many times, Chris Dunn. Dr. J.J. Hertek, also one of our other research directors with Stephen. J.J. is just an incredible archaeologist and researcher. So I'm, George, and I mean that in sincerity, I'm very humbled to to work with these people. They're incredible researchers, and I think they're providing answers to the Great Pyramid. And, you know, maybe we haven't solved it yet, but I think we're going in the right direction.
Why do we get so many different theories about what the use of the pyramids are? I mean, we hear things from power plants to made for the pharaohs, messengers to deliver the dead to the spirit world, all kinds of things. Why do we get so many diverse theories about
that? I love that question. I love it because, theories are a dime a dozen, or hypotheses are a dime a dozen. You can come up with anything. And a lot of them are good. They sound good. Some have more facts than others. But I think, like anything, the first thing, it's a mystery. Like the Shroud or Stonehenge, you look at the structure, the Great Pyramid, and right away you rule out, okay, it couldn't have been done in this traditional way, the way academic Egyptologists say. And so your mind starts working, and you start to think, what are the possibilities? Now, an engineer is going to look at it in an engineering fashion. A physicist may look at it in terms of physics, a mathematician in terms of mathematics. So I think the answer to your question is you have a diverse group of people with different backgrounds and disciplines and interests that look at the pyramid through their own eyes, through their own background, and they see a part of it. Now, I always say this. I think no one has got the answer yet. I think everyone's got a little piece of it, but I believe when the answer is found, and I can speculate too, it is going to be big. It is going to be way above what any of these other theories are. I think these could all be secondary effects, that there's some major, for example, let's say, you know, we discovered a time machine from an ancient culture, but we didn't know what it was. Somebody
right.
could say, well, you know, it was used to generate energy. Well, it was used to travel. It was used to make things, maybe like transform metals. But the ultimate purpose was something way beyond all these secondary effects. And I think the pyramid is like that. So we get many theories and many ideas. But I always say as a scientist, theories are a dime a dozen. We need the data, the repeatability, the peer review to make one theory more credible than the other. But I don't want to get the impression we don't want to stifle new ideas and new thoughts. That's how discoveries are made. And I think, unfortunately, academics tend to be too narrowed. And that's why I consider myself an alternative researcher and encourage people thinking of new ideas. But I always say, come up with facts, come up with data to substantiate, and that'll make your theory better or more important than someone else's.
Well, you know, all I know is that with the pyramids, we've got blocks of stone that cannot be made by even current standards. We don't have cranes big enough to move them, and they somehow were able to move huge tonnage of blocks.
Yeah, you know, when you think about it, you know, the blocks weighed between 2 and 70 tons. There's several million blocks of limestone. And then we didn't even talk about the interior passages to precise.
Well, and also the other question, too, John, is how do you, if assuming they were able to cut these blocks of stone out, 70 tons, they block them out. How do they cut it out? How do you get underneath it to cut it out to lift it out?
Yeah, I mean, good point. How do you move them into place that would have to be an incredible speed to have built this thing in 20 years? And even the cement that they used for the blocks, it's of unknown chemical composition, and the blocks will break before the joints will. I mean, it is amazing. They're put together with laser precision, and the academic Egyptologists are telling me it was done by ancient Egyptians using primitive tools and hauling blocks up ramps with sledges. I mean, no way. I mean, and I think that when you mention why so many people get involved in the different ideas, this is the thing. This right away people say it can't have been done. And you've seen on TV where they've had they tried to rebuild, make small pyramids, and they failed miserably. They can't even make a small pyramid with these type of blocks.
So true. I know there is that theory, the poured theory, that the blocks were all poured. Let's get your take on that when we come back. I remember Margaret Morris was a guest of mine several years ago. She believes in the poured theory. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. John DeSalvo. We'll get into the Russian and Ukrainian research. And yes, what about levitation? Did those ETs build the pyramids? John, I've got the network working on a project to get me down in Egypt for maybe a week to do a series of live shows out there. Do you get out there very often?
No, I really don't. And can I just follow up on the pouring hypothesis?
Yeah. I was going to come back to that, but I wanted to see if you were going to be out there.
I actually, George, made a pledge not to visit Giza until I finished my first book.
Really?
Yeah. It was very interesting. A couple reasons. One is I found out that Peter Tompkins, who wrote Secrets of the Great Pyramid, you're probably familiar with that book, that had brought more people to the pyramid research, I think, than any other book. I heard that he did not visit the Great Pyramid until he published his book.
It was his thing, I guess.
Yeah, and the other thing was I realized that most of my colleagues and friends who went to Giza kind of went with an open mind, and then when they came back, they had their own pet theory. So my decision was to wait until I put out my book, and I wanted to be open to all theories and report on everyone equally and unbiased, and I thought, now that that's done, can I come with you on your trip?
Yeah, I think we can work that out.
That would be great.
We can get a whole bunch of people together.
Yeah, interesting. So, you mentioned about, the pouring hypothesis.
Yeah, I'm going to get in with you on levitation and high technology and ET technology, and we're going to kick some theories around. But if it happened to have been made by man alone, conventionally, I don't believe that they were able to chisel out these rocks and pull them and move them. I could believe the poured theory if that's the theory I ended up with. I mean, we'll talk about the other ones, and those I tend to believe more. But the poured theory I would believe more than the big block they dragged them around theory. Wouldn't you?
Well, yeah. When I first heard about that, I thought it was kind of creative because, I like diverse theories. And the only problem was the blocks, the limestone blocks that have been studied, most of them are pneumolitic limestone, meaning, sedimentary limestone, and there's fossils in it, so it wouldn't have been poured. But that's not necessarily to say that part of the pyramid could have been poured or other monuments. So, I think more studies need to be done. I think they've got some very interesting engineers kind of on their side with that theory. But one of the earliest visitors to the Great Pyramid was John Greaves, who was professor of astronomy. In 1638, when he published his book, identified the limestone as pneumolitic also. So the pouring is kind of a radical hypothesis, but, again, it's a possibility. I like the levitation one because that actually could possibly explain it more, but it's more of a reach in a sense of what we know. But some recent studies in terms of levitating objects may have some credibility to that type of theory.
Okay, so let's get in some of the other ones, some of the big ones. And also the Russian-Ukrainian work. What is that all about?
Well, that is just it was an incredible group of research. I found this out in 2001 when Dr. Vladimir Krasnoholovits, who is the senior scientist at the Institute of Physics in the Ukraine, contacted me to tell me that the Russians built like over 17 large fiberglass pyramids in 8 or 9 different locations in Russia and the Ukraine. And the largest was 144 feet high, weighed over 55 tons, and cost over $1 million to build. So we're talking about huge structures. And I think Lex posted some of those on your on your website, one of the largest pyramids. And what was fascinating about this, these were coordinated and undertaken by Alexander Gollett, who was director of a Russian state defense enterprise in Moscow. And he's the one who financed and is the brains behind this operation. And him and I have been kind of working together. I've been helping him to disseminate this information with his son Anatoly, who does speak English, and also with Dr. K. But what's so fascinating about these experiments is that they were done by some of the most leading institutes in the Soviet Union, like the National Academy of Sciences and pediatric institutes and microbiology labs. And so they were really scientifically designed. And I thought that was very, very fascinating that we have examples of large modern pyramids in which incredible experiments were done. And this took place between 1989 and is still going on to the present. And, let's see, did you want me to, oh, the angles, by the way, of the Russian pyramids are like about 73 degrees. So if your listeners look at the picture of the Russian pyramid, you could see that it's sloped at a more acute angle. And that was based on prototypes and the golden section. They believe that was part of it. And so that's why that angle of around 73 degrees was chosen. And that's why, because it's based on the golden section, all the pyramids have to be a ratio of the largest one, or that number, like 144 feet was the largest, 72 was the next one, you know, et cetera, 36 feet. So it's based on the golden section and prototypes. Anyway, it turns out they conducted experiments in terms of medicine, ecology, agriculture, physics, chemistry, and found out, I think the results were just amazing. And did you want me to get into some
of
those?
Sure.
Well, I think one of the most interesting tests was done by the Russian National Academy of Medical Sciences and its affiliates, like the Institute of Virology and Pediatrics, the Russian Institute of Pediatrics. What they did was they tried to look at the effect of what a pyramid would have. Now, here's what we're assuming, and we can talk about this more when we go into Joe Parr's research and some of the other Russian research, some type of energy field or whatever that the pyramids all over the world are producing. And this energy field...
Producing or drawing?
I'm sorry?
Producing the energy or drawing it down from somewhere?
That's a good question. It depends on who you ask. But very excellent observation. You get an A-plus in my class.
Thank you, Professor.
It could be a combination of both. The Russians, I think, believe it is being created, but Dr. Kay also believes it could have be drawn from the atmosphere and other places. They looked at the effect of this pyramid force or the pyramids on antibodies that protect us from, you know, virus and bacterial infections. So what they did was they placed a type of antibody in the Great Pyramids for a period of time, and then they put it together and with viruses, specific viruses from a mouse. And what they found out, it was significantly the immunoglobulins or the antibodies that were placed in the pyramid had a significant increase in the immunology.
Isn't that amazing?
Killing the viruses and bacteria. Incredible.
Jeez. Okay, so we're going to invent a little pyramid wand, you know, like they had in Star Trek or something, and just go,
you know, who knows, but that was significant because it was carried out, you know, with the Russian Academy of Sciences, and they also injected mice with specific bacteria that had a deadly bacterial infection, which most mouse would die within a short period of time.
Sure, they should have.
Right, but what they also decided to do that was a control group, okay, and then they put the pyramid, the animals, into the pyramids, and also a certain type of antibiotic, and it turned out that the mouse that were subjected to the pyramids survived
with the same kind of virus,
right? And they survived with a 30-45% survival rate.
Yeah, see?
Whereas all the other mouse died. It was a very deadly type of infection.
You have to conclude that somehow the pyramid was able to do some kind of massive energy healing.
Exactly. It seems like it's increasing the body to produce a better immunity. It's producing the antibodies to produce the
Is it just the shape of the pyramid that does it, John?
Yes, that's what the theory is, that it's producing this energy. And that's why the prototypes and the golden section and all these ratios are very important in the Russians determining how to design the pyramids. Now, that's obviously a different shape than the Great Pyramid, but we do find the energy fields on all these pyramids. So the shape may make it more specific, but another interesting study, just to kind of finish up the medical studies, was that the Russian Institute of Pediatrics, Obstetrics, and Gynecology did a study in which they took solutions of glucose, which is, you know, simple sugars, and they gave certain newborns just this plain glucose, and they gave other newborns glucose that was placed in the pyramids for a period of time.
Right.
And the newborns that were given these had, they called low indexes, or they did not have good, you know, readings. You know, they were not normal. Some were more sickly. And it turned out that almost all the children given the pyramid exposed solutions improved far quicker and became much faster normal children or newborns than the control group. So they also placed seeds that 20 different varieties of seeds were placed in their pyramids. And then they sowed them in a field with the control group seeds that were not placed. That's why I like the Russian research, George. It was done in a very controlled manner, very scientific. You have a control group and an experimental group. It turns out, you ready for this? The yield and crop with the pyramid placed seeds was 20 to 100%, depending on the type of seed.
Now, here's the question. How did they know back thousands and thousands of years ago that a structure like a pyramid could be used for this incredible healing or energy? How did they know this unless they were told? This is not something you could guess about or stumble into.
You know, that's a really, I never heard that, said that before, but that is a really good observation because, yeah, it isn't something that different cultures are just going to, like you say, stumble upon these structures of this size. It's something that you would think this information would have to have been given to them, or someone would have to have built it for them. So especially we find them all over the world in different parts, different cultures, and different times. Good point.
Truly amazing. You know, my story when I was younger, had a friend who did not do very well in school, John. I don't know where in the heck he read this, but he read something about pyramids and the power of pyramids. He would come to school, he'd take it off in class eventually after the teachers got after him, but he'd wear a pyramid hat. He would. He looked like Tom Terrific, who had that little canister thing on his head almost. But he would, he'd wear a pyramid hat. And I'm telling you, he started acing his courses. Now, that's weird.
That is, you know, or maybe because he was smart, he got interested in the pyramids, right?
He wasn't that sharp in the beginning.
So this really actually helped. Well, you never know. I mean, again, this would be consistent with some of the studies we're talking about. You see, that's why I encourage theories and hypotheses and ideas. And like I said, you know, I don't like to have my own because, like I said, as director of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, I think I'm probably the only one that doesn't have a theory, and I really wanted it to be like that I'm objective to all of them. I mean, I can be critical give you my opinion, but I really did not want to have a theory while I'm directing this association, and I think that's good because I kind of look at it overall and not through blinders, and somebody who may come up with something weird or strange most people would reject, I would look at it with an open mind. So, you know, I don't have a lot of strengths, but I think one of my strengths is my openness and my willingness to look at new ideas and explore new avenues.
They should shape houses like pyramids.
I can't tell you how many emails I get during the year of people wanting to build a house in pyramid shapes and asking me for dimensions, which I really can't give. Everything I have is in my book. I mean, I don't really have any extra information, but it's up to the person. There's different shapes and angles, and look at the pyramid at the Louvre and some office buildings that are built on the pyramid design.
I've got two pyramids back to back, all right, glued in my studio here in Los Angeles, hanging from a little wire, and it's just in here, just radiating whatever it's giving out.
See, that's why you're the number one talk radio show.
Actually, it's because of art, but maybe it's what's kept me number one. I'll buy that.
But, you know, you see, George, the fascination, I mean, again, talk about being open. You're open to so many ideas. Just look at the show, and you are always been very fascinated with the pyramids. It grabs you. It draws you to them for some reason. You know the simple explanation.
Since I was a kid.
Yeah, I bet you were interested in other mysteries. I bet when you heard of Stonehenge and UFOs, and I got interested in UFOs when I was in junior high. Actually, it was interesting. I tried to compile every UFO sighting that was done at that time, which, actually now we have somebody doing it. I was in junior high when I started doing it, but like you, I was always interested in the mystery. And see, that's why I think the Coast to Coast audience is the greatest audience in the world. I love this show because you have people on that listen to the show that think like us. They're open to new theories and possibilities. And you look back through history, I feel every great discovery, or most of the great discoveries, were made by people even outside the field, not necessarily academias or PhDs, but the average person, somebody thinking in a non-traditional way. But again, they followed it up with scientific methods and testing and data. And so, you know, it's a privilege to come on this show to talk about these things and encourage others to think about them. And that's why, you know, I love people visiting our website. Like I said, I think we're probably the most popular website in the Great Pyramid or Pyramid Research on the net. And I just love hearing from people. So, and I do read all my email. I can't tell you how much I get, but I love it. I love hearing people's individual stories and their encouragements and their suggestions. So this has been a joy for me. And I don't look at myself as a researcher. I look at more as a compiler. You know, George, I've compiled over 200 or 300 books on the Great Pyramid. I have a copy of John Greaves from 1638. And I know all the researchers. I have the information. And that's why I was real excited about putting my book together with all the information, because I want to make it available to everybody. And I think this will encourage new ideas and new research.
Absolutely. If you had a chance to talk with Zahi Hawass, head of Egypt's Antiquities, what one question, John, would you ask him?
That was the other reason. I said, I don't want to go to Egypt until I can personally handle Zahi, my book. And what I would like to say to Zahi is, if I could see him face to face, and actually that's what I will plan on doing. I would like to walk up to him and give him a copy of my book and say, Zahi, these are the theories that you should be looking at
while you flee Egypt.
Yeah. Why can't you look at this with an open mind? These are theories that have been going back hundreds of years. They all are legitimate. And you have really reduced the study of the pyramids to some narrow area that is probably not even true. I don't know, maybe I wouldn't say that, but that's what I feel, because my whole motivation in this is to encourage new ideas and new research and to solve the answer. Look, the Great Pyramid was not built by the Egyptians. I mean, this is my opinion again, okay? Like I said, I don't have a theory, but it was not built by the Egyptians. It wasn't built in a primitive manner. There is no way. The ramps used to have built it that they say would have been bigger than the pyramids, you know? I mean, and we, like you talked about, the trimming of the blocks, the movement, the inner passage.
Well, when I'm broadcasting out there, I better be ready to get my lines clipped if we say that, huh?
Yeah, well, you know,
you never know.
I hate to say that, but it's a possibility. But I hope you do that, and I would love to be there for that, because I think maybe we can get Zahi to come over, and I can personally hand him my book and shake his hand.
Oh, yeah. I mean, part of the whole arrangement would be that he's going to be there with us. Stay with us. We're going to talk about how the pyramids might have been built. Was it an ET connection? Levitation? I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. John, why was there such an interest in the capstone on the top of the pyramid?
Well, because I think as far back as the time of Christ, if not earlier, the reports was that there was no capstone on the pyramid. So that raises the question, maybe it wasn't looted or destroyed. Maybe it was built without a capstone. Maybe one of the purposes of the pyramid, its function, was that the top had to be flat. Another possibility could be that that's the powerhouse, the power-generating part, and there is a capstone, and maybe that's hidden somewhere. Maybe that's what puts the pyramid, gets it going, whatever it does, you know, and there's a lot of theories which we can talk about regarding that. But that's the fascinating thing, because, see, some early writers to the pyramids, like for thousands of years ago, talk about the casing stone being intact, but yet it still lacked the capstone. So that's very mysterious, and I think that's why almost all pyramids had the capstone. That was the cornerstone. That was the most highly decorated part, made of gold or polished metal. So it's a big mystery, and we don't know for sure. Some scientists think it was never intentionally wasn't finished. Some think we may discover it somewhere. Maybe it's hidden somewhere in the pyramid or below the surface. So very, very interesting question.
Do you ever get into the Sphinx at all?
Not too much, except Dr. Robert Schock's work and John Anthony West. John's on our board with the erosion studies, which is to me one of the greatest scientific studies in Egyptology, where they showed the erosion on the Sphinx and the Sphinx wall had to have taken place at least 5,000, if not 10,000 years ago, because it was produced by rainfall. It was produced by rainfall, and that there wasn't anything significant like that since that time. So their erosion studies to me are very fascinating, and that's another nice piece of evidence that's showing that the Great Pyramid is a lot older than the Fourth Dynasty, 2500 BC. So what the Sphinx is, these thought of, remember the under the paw of the Sphinx, there's the
The Hall of Records.
And I love that. I was a member of ARE, Edgar Cayce Foundation, and they have been one of the kindest to me in terms of my Andrew Jackson Davis research, and I have all of Casey's readings, and I just think, again, I'm open to all the different ideas, but I think the Hall of Records is very, very fascinating, and it would be wonderful if something like that did exist. Would that be behind one of the, remember the doors in the shaft exploration, or is it somewhere else in the pyramid? Is it below the paw of the Sphinx? But there were some seismographic studies done not too long ago that identified, I think Cayce said it was under the right paw, but I think these studies showed it under the left, if I'm not mistaken, that there's some square, hollow cavity.
There's
but
something
obviously,
down there.
You know, Zahi didn't give permission to go any further. So,
I think he's already dug it up.
You know, I ponder that on and off. I look at it this way. I wouldn't put it past him. But on the other hand, if he did something like an exploration that wasn't, known secretly, you can't cover that up. You can't bore through limestone and cover it up. And I don't know if he'd want to go down in history as someone who did that, unless he had permission from the Egyptian Supreme Antiquities Council. But I don't know. I'd like to think he wouldn't, but, George, I wouldn't put it past him. So.
All right, I'm going to throw out some possibilities on how the pyramids were built.
Sure.
You react to them, all right? First of all, levitating the stones.
That's my favorite.
Well,
remember I said theory, but I can have my favorite theory. I like the levitation the best because it explains so many things. The question your audience and everyone will ask is, well, what's the scientific theory behind it? Can it be done? And the answer is yes. Bell Labs back in the 1980s produced partial levitation by sound. Many of your listeners, I know, are familiar with John Keeley, the American inventor who lived in Pennsylvania in the 19th century and claimed to be able to have levitated, metal balls and other objects. Then we have the Coral Castle mystery, Ed Leed Scalman, who supposedly moved 20 to 30 ton blocks by himself, a small little guy, there's ancient legends, tons of Arab legends of levitation and all types of mythology, which I think wherever you find a story and a myth, there's a piece of truth behind it. Levitation to me would be the most logical scientific way that the Great Pyramid would have been built. Now, would the ancient Egyptians have this knowledge? Of course not. Where would they have gotten it? Well,
that's a good question.
That is, that's the number one question, really.
Could have been an advanced Earth civilization, like
right,
an Atlantean
exactly.
civilization with incredible knowledge. You know, if if societies and civilizations were much older than we think, Michael Cremo believes it in his work, maybe the technology was absolutely incredible then. They had it. That's a possibility, isn't it, John?
Yeah, I love Michael Cremo's works and books. Yeah, I agree with you. And I give a list, you know, when people ask me, like you could say, we were very much advanced 10,000, 50,000 years ago, but, you know, no artifacts are going to last that long, so we have no record of a, you know, it was solely a human evolution and advance in technology that died out. Other possibilities could be, you know, Atlantis, if Atlantis really existed, aliens, other dimensional beings. You know, look at super string theory, which has been one of my interests. Now they postulate that there's 11 plus other dimensions. I mean, so this is not science fiction anymore. It's science. I don't think it's unscientific to look at aliens and multidimensional time travel, all these other theories, because we don't have an answer. We have to open up the realm of possibilities. But again, you know, we have to look at the science. And so I'm open to all those.
Well, that's a possibility. Now, you've heard of Edward Leed Skolnick from Coral Castle, right?
Of course, yes.
He moved those blocks somehow, too, and he moved them by himself. There's no way this guy could have done it by himself. And, you know, he may have had that pulley tripod to position these things, but he surely didn't move them.
You know what I heard about him from, I'm not sure if it was from Dr. Hertek or from Dr. Flanagan, who visited Coral Castle real back early, you know, back in the 70s, mm-hmm. before then, before it was kind of done over, cleaned up. And they told me that there were wires all over the place, in the ground. And it was a strange box he had. So I, you know, from hearing these stories, it may be interesting, some kind of a electrostatic generator or something reversing the effect of gravity.
Because he believed in magnetics. And
right,
I think
exactly.
What he did was, you know, how, you know, the two magnetic fields alike, you know, repel each other instead of attract. I think he was able to do that with these stones and the planet and kind of like repel it and just kind of like push these things as they floated.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's a real possibility. And look at gravity now. Way physicists look at gravity, it should be a lot stronger than it is. So they postulate that the gravitons are actually more in other dimensions. I mean, when you read theoretical physics and quantum physics and all the string theory, I mean, that really sounds like science fiction. And I believe that these new areas, these new theories of physics may open up some light onto these mysteries of the Great Pyramid and levitation and ancient civilizations. It's real exciting.
What about ET visitation?
Yeah, definitely is a possibility. Again, I've been fascinated with UFOs since high school. I actually did a couple of radio programs with Stan Friedman and Colonel Jesse Marcel Jr.
Sure.
Because I was discovered that Barney and Betty Hill abduction.
Right.
Well, Betty, under hypnosis, drew some diagrams of a book that she saw aboard the spacecraft. Stanton is the expert on this, but basically when they were abducted, they underwent hypnosis years later, and they recalled what happened, and she said the alien showed her this book. And where I was interested is she actually drew this diagram, and it just came out in Stanton's book, and very few people, I think, have seen it. It was in the appendix of his book. And when I looked at that, I thought, you know, that looks familiar, because I also had a copy that Jesse Marcel had drawn of the I-beams that he remembered it when he recovered it was at the crash site at Roswell. And Colonel Jesse Marcel Jr., who I know, actually looked at the photo and said that he believed his father did draw it because it was signed by him. And I found a similarity in some of the script between those two different UFO encounters, and actually it even matched some script of a new book that is being published that I'm writing for Inner Traditions on the Seeress of Prevorst, where she wrote an angelic language. So, I mean, it may sound kind of strange, but we may have a correlation of some kind of original language that's unique to other worlds, to the angelic or spiritual world. And that's what I've been working on, actually, the real Da Vinci Code, the real angelic language. And I think that's why, you know, I don't want to say I'm a firm believer in alien visitation, but I'm really going in that direction because of all these correlations that I'm coming upon. I get into everything, don't I?
You sure do. Well, you know, alien visitations is a very strong possibility. Then the question is what the heck did they use this thing for?
Yeah.
If they made it, why?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just for the beauty of it or for a tomb or for...
a directional finder, nothing.
Yeah.
Or any of that.
And, you know, like I said, you take all the different theories, and they all seem to be a part of it, but it has to be something bigger than that. And that's why I love all the theories. Oh, before I forget, if I could just make one suggestion, one request from your audience, if I could.
Sure.
You know, my new book that came out, Decoding the Pyramids, which is published by Barnes & Noble, which I'm totally honored that they're doing it because I love the store. It's if you buy a copy, buy two copies and give one, donate one to your local public library or university library. I really believe this book should be in the hands of students and educators. And this has been a real dedication. It's only like $12.98, of 200 pages of color diagrams and a hardcover. I mean, it's the best bargain out there, and I did it for dedication. I never do anything for money, but it has all the known theories, and this is what I've been an educator all my life. I was a college professor, a high school teacher, you name it. I taught. I was a lecturer, and the most exciting thing for me is to stimulate young people to get into new areas of research and open their minds beyond just the narrow academia and what they see. And I think this book is really a good means of doing that. And I'm not just saying it because it's not really my work. I look at myself as more of a compiler of all the things that have been out there for the last 200 or 300 years or 2,000 years. So, I really would like to see this in educational institutions. So maybe someday they would use it as a textbook, but who knows? That would be way in the future.
Tell me about the story of Napoleon's visit to the King's Chamber.
Oh, I love that one. That was one of my favorite ones that I heard. That Napoleon, you know, when he went into Egypt in battle, after he had some time, he decided to visit the Great Pyramid and asked to be left alone in the King's Chamber. And supposedly, when he came out, he looked visibly shaken, was the words. And his aide asked him what happened, and he said, "I never want you to mention this to me again." And that was it. Nobody ever brought it up. And then and a couple decades later, when he was on his deathbed, supposedly again, one of his close friends said to him, "What happened when you were in the King's Chamber? You never told anyone." And he started to say something and stopped and looked at him and said, "Well, what's the use? You'd never believe me." So it's a mystery. You know, did he see some kind of vision, some kind of future? Amazing story.
It is an amazing story. The King's Chamber. Go ahead.
Oh, it's just people from all walks of life have been drawn to the Great Pyramid and its meaning, or pyramids from South America or from all over the world. And that's, again, you know, what is this intrinsic thing about pyramids? You know, I mentioned that because they're monuments, we tend to look up to God. If you look at everything I do, George, whether it's the Shroud, the Great Pyramid, my books on Andrew Jackson Davis, you know, the Clairvoyant, the Seerist of Prevorst, I'm always searching for God or for cosmic consciousness or for the truth. I believe all these things point to that direction. And by studying them and opening ourselves up to them, it may lead us to this light, to this truth. You know what it is, I don't have the answer. And so pyramids wake up something in our subconscious or unconsciousness or a spiritual part of us, our soul, whatever you want to call it. And I think something resonates to say, this is going to help me find out who I am, where I'm going, what is God? Am I part of God, my path to God? And that's why anything that I'm interested always has that common denominator as a search for God. And you asked the question, which I think is the right question, why? And the reason is, We want to know who we are. We want to know about God, our origins, our destiny. We cover it up in our lives by materialistic things. We say, oh, we want a bigger house or a bigger car or more money or a better job. But really what we want is spiritual knowledge, spiritual truth. I like the word cosmic consciousness. That's what we really want.
And we want to tap into it.
Yeah, but we tend to get diverted into the, not that we shouldn't make a living and have a job, support our family, but too many have closed themselves off to this channel. And I think that's why we have so many problems in life, so many psychological problems, so many disasters. People have turned off their true purpose in life, and that to me is finding God. So I didn't mean to philosophize, but that's my common denominator in all my research, whether it's aliens or whether it's the pyramid or whether it's the shroud or whatever, Noah's Ark. I was even involved in
Ask you this, John. You know, to me, you know, knowledge is a chronology. People pick up knowledge and it's carried on, you know, and in our era over the last 500 years, 1,000 years, there's been a chronology of passing information along. And even though they didn't have printing presses and things in the earlier days of the pyramids, something happened where knowledge, the knowledge of the pyramids, was gone. There was a group of people who witnessed the pyramids being built. They knew how they were built. Why wasn't that carried on? There are no works that I know of anywhere, no texts, nothing that tells people who built them and how they were built. It's almost as if we have this huge missing gap. Why?
Yeah, that is an excellent observation, and it's so true. And I do believe exactly what you said, that there was a record of this somewhere. There was this knowledge, and all of a sudden, it's gone. There's some inscription supposedly attributed to Colonel Weiss. I don't even want to get into that in the relieving chambers of the, you know, the chambers above the King's Chamber, but people have questioned if that was forged or not. But essentially, there's really no markings or writings in the pyramids that tell us anything about it, who did it, why, or when. No papyrus that were found, no, even in pyramid text, the Book of the Dead. But, you know, there's some similarities, but nothing at all. Why? Is that what's in the Hall of Records? Is that hidden somewhere? Can we maybe find it? I don't know. You see, the other problem is with the pyramid chronology. Traditional Egyptologists put the pyramid in the fourth dynasty, and they show pyramids leading up to it, the step pyramid, and they put it in their sequence. But the Great Pyramid of Giza is so unique. I say in my book, it's like it came out of nowhere. And then I feel all the other pyramids were then poor imitations that the ancient Egyptians tried to do to copy it. It's like they inherited this land, this culture, and now they see this pyramid there, which is ancient. And, you know, when I say ancient, George, I'm not talking 5,000, 10,000 years. We may be talking 50,000, 100,000.
Right.
And I'm not the only one who feels this way.
And then whatever civilization was there was gone for a long time.
Yes, completely. And the records, unless, again, they are. See, that's why the exploration of the pyramid is so important. Are there records in the pyramid? Are there records in the Sphinx?
Something's down there, John. We'll be back in a moment. We're going to open up Fast Blasts. I'll take your Fast Blast questions for the next half hour before we get into your real phone calls next hour. John, let's go to some questions here. A. Thompson in Brooklyn, New York, wants to know about the angles of the pyramids and why they're so important.
Sure. Good question. That is an important observation, that all pyramids do not have the same angle. And you may think they should, because we're talking about some kind of energy field and angles and whatever would cause a certain kind of resonance, but they don't. The Great Pyramid has an angle of around 51.5 degrees. The slope of the Russian pyramids around 73 degrees, and I mentioned other pyramids around the world. Some are flatter, not as acute. There's a whole gamut of them. My guess, again, is that, you know, the basic structure is the pyramidal shape, but the angle is going to affect the type of energy or the way it's produced or what it's going to affect. And this is just my speculation, that the Russian pyramid energies are producing maybe different effects than the energy of the Great Pyramid of Giza, but they still have certain effects in common. Is that kind of kind of see what I'm saying?
It's sure.
But that's just my speculation. But the pyramid shape is the thing that's unique. So and it's good to look at the different pyramids around the world and see that there are, you know, different angles. And like I said, different shape. Even like I mentioned, the pyramid, if those pyramids on Mars are really pyramids, some are three-sided, some are five-sided, and some are four-sided. So you have even a variety of sides.
Tony,
I'm from New York originally, too, so hi in Brooklyn.
There you go. Tony from Albuquerque wants to know about the stars in the belt system of constellation Orion, much like the way the pyramids are shaped.
That's a good observation. I think Robert Bavall and Graham Hancock, and also actually J.J. Hertek also was an original, I think, discoverer of that. But they Robert Bavall made it public in his book, The Orion Mystery, where he thought the three pyramids on the Giza Plateau were aligned like the three stars in the belt of the constellation Orion, and maybe the Milky Way could have represented the Nile. Very interesting. I mean, if you make an exact correlation, it's not the same. There's some differences, but again, a very unique observation. You know what it means? I'm not sure. I mean, you know, certain of the shafts are pointed towards constellations, and there's a whole thing, as we know, with ancient Egypt. Their whole culture is based on the stars and the constellations. When the pharaoh died, he would go out in space and become a star. And so in terms of their religious cult and their mythology, constellations are a very integral part of the Egyptian culture. But then we go back and say, we don't believe the Egyptians built the Great Pyramid. So, you know, are we putting something from one time together with something that's not? So I think it's an interesting observation, but me personally, I really don't pursue that because I think it may just be a coincidence.
Joe from Toronto, do you think that massive amounts of slaves and giant mammoths or something were used to move those massive stones?
No, I don't think so. It's a good question, Joe. Somebody even have suggested the giants, like, you know, in the Bible, in Genesis, in chapter 6, they talk about, you know, giants and you know, that could explain part of the lifting. But how do you get the precision? And, you know, something that looks like there's advanced machining, advanced technology, a laser precision. So, you know, it could solve part of the mystery, but not all of it. Again, you know, very good question.
Durin from Alabama, interesting question here for you. What if the pyramids were built by ancient races of giants? So it was easier to move these blocks.
Yeah, again, excellent. I find that very, again, fascinating because of, like I mentioned, the stories in the Bible about giants and the idea that obviously a giant could pick up a 20-ton brick probably with ease. But again, the big problem is the other technology. How have they developed the cement and polished them, the internal chambers and the advanced machining. So it could be part of the solution. You know, it could be maybe some of the large megaliths like Stonehenge and others were built by giants. So, I like questions like that because this person is taking some different a different aspect, some mythology or some history, ancient history, and putting it together with another part, and I think that's really good thinking. That's what I like to see, because that's how we come up with new ideas.
Brandon, California. Do you know anything about the hieroglyph of an ancient alien gray found in one of the pyramids? He says, I've seen a picture of it somewhere. Looks as if it's aged as the writings have around it. Did you ever hear that?
An ancient alien ray?
Gray.
Gray.
You know, gray alien.
Oh, yeah.
Big heads.
You know, no, I'm not aware of that. I mean, I know I've seen some pictures of from ancient cultures that, you know, with the oblong head and that would resemble could possibly resemble aliens, I know even in China, but whether that's humans that were made to look like that or what. I would say if you have information on that or a photo of that, please email it to me. You know, just go to my website and it says email the director. I'd be very interested in seeing anything like that that could be related to aliens.
Were the pyramids on ley lines as they are in Coral Castle?
Oh, God, what good questions. Oh, man. Yeah, I don't know. Ley lines is such a fascinating topic. In fact, Joe Parr even studied ley lines. But I believe they are. I mean, I haven't measured them. You know, there's really some – I get so many emails. People ask me, do you have maps of ley lines? And I think other authors have put some out, but do we really know if those are really ley lines or not?
Yeah, we don't.
I do believe monuments like the Great Pyramid and Stonehenge and some of the others are built on ley lines, because the other thing we found out, other researchers found out, that it appears that in some of these ancient monuments, there's higher levels of radioactivity than in the surrounding area. Like even in the King's Chamber, an investigator measured higher levels of radioactivity. And now there's evidence that that higher levels of radioactivity may lead to higher levels of altering states of consciousness. So maybe ancient cultures built these sites in areas that have high levels of radioactivity associated with ley lines or you know, who knows, some kind of correlation. But I think ley lines could be one of the most promising studies of new energy fields ever, because I think Coral Castle was built on a ley line. So even though I can't prove it, I don't have a map that I can show you, maybe others do, I would believe it would be.
Tom, from Atlanta, Georgia, give us a best guess again, age and origin of the pyramids, in your opinion.
My honest opinion, I'd say 10,000 years plus, which could be 50,000 or 100. I mean, it's way out there. What was the other question? Like who built it?
Yeah. Well, the age of the pyramids and the origin. Yeah.
I'm leaning towards possibly extraterrestrials, other dimensional creatures, even time. Who knows if it's the time traveler phenomenon? I mean, again, this is science fiction, it sounds like, but you know, these are all possibilities. That I've been involved now with studying more of UFOs and aliens and the scripts, I have a completely different perspective, George, than I had several years ago. So I'm tending to lean more towards the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
And what if the Anunnaki built them? Part of Zachariah Sitchin's work.
You know, I read a lot of his books years ago, and I enjoyed it, but I kind of read it more science fiction. The man's brilliant in terms of his, you know, Assyrian and Babylonian translations of his cuneiform. I mean, there may be some evidence in his work that he has uncovered, you know, alien contacts and ancient civilization. But I think he takes it kind of a step far with some of his other theories. But again, he's a brilliant researcher. I love his work, and so, yeah, something to look at. You know, this may all come together. I mean, you know, remember I always said I don't think anybody's one theory is 100% right, but I think parts of different people's theories are correct. And when you start, you know, you take a little of Zachariah Sitchin, you take a little bit of this and that, and put them together. Because it seems like in ancient cultures there's this evidence of extraterrestrial contact.
What about the burning of the library in Alexandria? Maybe they had some pyramid information there.
Yeah, that
possible.
You know,
I don't know.
If I believed in reincarnation, which I'm not sure, everything's I'm open to, but I think I would have lived at that time because I just love books. I mean, I'm totally addicted to antiquarian books and manuscripts, and I dream of the Library of Alexandria. And I believe, yes, that there was such a library that had vast amounts of information that maybe described the pyramid, maybe described ancient cultures. Just thinking of it, I'm in awe of a library like that. Can you imagine somebody saying that we found the we have the Library of Alexandria reconstructed. You can spend as much time as you want in there. What secrets it would hold?
Roxanne from Florida, the pyramids have had to have gone through Noah's flood, but where are all of Noah's family survived? So does that mean that the Egyptians moved into the area of the pyramids? What do you think?
Oh, interesting question. First of all, that's a really big question, because was there actually a flood or a universal flood or not? I tend to think it was more of a local or regional flood. I did some research into this years ago. I actually was involved for a short time with the search committee in the search for Noah's Ark. I knew Colonel Jim Irwin, and I actually have a piece of the alleged Noah's Ark wood from the Navarre expedition, which I was going to radiocarbon date for them. But so I'm not an expert in this area, but I dabbled in it. And I think where a lot of the search committee people believed in a universal flood, I thought the evidence was more local, dendrochronology, study of tree rings. University of Arizona is one of the top places when I was there talking to those people. There's really no evidence of a universal flood, and there would be. So I think it was a big local flood, which could have been considered universal at the time. Whether it infiltrated, whether it was in Egypt or not, is another question. So you're really bringing up a lot of possibilities, and we just don't know. We would need to have more information, regarding the flood.
I love this question from Roy in California. We heard about the myth of the magic floating carpet. What if they were floating the stones?
That is excellent. Because actually,
good tie-in, huh?
You know, I wish I had all these people in my classes, because this is the kind of stuff that I like. I actually have a section in my book on that in terms of Arab legends, exactly what Roy was talking about, that there are specific Arab legends. One said that the pyramids were put on a piece of paper, and then it was struck, and the blocks floated into place like a magic carpet. So there's actually Arab legends that talk about that. So excellent, Roy. You get an A+ too.
Edgar Casey in Readings of Reincarnation, according to Rob in Alabama, indicated the pyramids were assembled via projections of the mind. I've never seen that. Have you?
No, that's interesting, because the idea of...
I have to double-check that one.
Mind over matter. No, I'll have to check that. Edgar Casey, I have the all his readings on CD, which can be searched quite easily. So that's interesting. You know, because let's face it, we know mind does have control over matter, but the question is, could there have been a culture that mind was so powerful that, you know, that actually could levitate and assemble things, like be almost like alchemy, you know?
Danny from Columbus, Ohio. Maybe the pyramids were built by humans who have since left the planet.
Built by humans and what?
They've left the planet.
Yeah, very good possibility. You know, that's one thing I was going to mention, too. How do we know that a very, very ancient civilization had space travel and left things out there? And when we look at, say, we think there's aliens or contacts in outer space, they're just ancestors of humans that went in space or something. Interesting. Very good question. Really makes you think, doesn't it?
Maggie from San Francisco, Book of Enoch, talks about 200 angels that taught man all the arts, and perhaps they're the ones believed to have built the pyramids.
Oh, I love it. The Book of Enoch, which never made the Bible. When I taught Bible study, I did a whole section on the Book of Enoch. If any of you are interested in apocryphal Old Testament books, you got to get it. Get a good translation of it. Yeah, it really talks about that, you know, about the fallen angels. It fills in. By the way, most of Catholic angelology is based on the Book of Enoch. It talks about fallen angels and how they taught man all kinds of the art of war, and even things like herbs and some things that we may consider good, but very, very strange book. And it talks about Enoch's travel through the different dimensions and planes and worlds. It's a very mysterious book. In fact, to me, a very metaphysical study. If you study it, like I said, with an open mind, with a spiritual perspective, and not just with you're going to dissect it as a scholarly approach, and I think the Book of Enoch could be very, very, very uplifting. Very great questions, George.
Marilyn from Tulsa. Could hot air balloons have been used to build the pyramids? Man, I don't think they could have lifted those stones.
Who?
Hot air balloons.
Hot air balloons. Huh.
I don't think so, though.
No, I don't either. You know, talk about very good insight, even though, you know, hot air balloons were invented around the 1700s. Excellent. Hot air balloons, you know, it's interesting. I love these questions because they bring up so many things. As a teacher, you always like to bring up the Civil War. The Union experimented with hot air balloons in terms of seeing where the Confederate forces were, and they abandoned that early in the Civil War. And I thought if they would have kept it up, who knows what would have happened. So hot air balloons are a very interesting area of study.
Maybe they were easy to shoot down.
Yeah, with a big cannon especially.
Big target. David has this great one for Irvine, California. What are the possibilities of stargates existing at the location of the pyramids?
Well, that's what I believe could be very important. My God, the time went so quickly. I didn't even get into Joe Parr's research.
Well,
but
we're
not done.
You got another hour.
Oh, that's good. Well, you know,
we're going to take calls and talk about Joe.
Yeah, I think Joe Parr's research leads to that. And I think, remember I said, George, when we find out what the answer is, it's going to be something big, not something small. And I believe whether it's a stargate, time travel, interdimensional travel, that is what we're going to find out, maybe the overall purpose. So, yes, and I think that person is thinking the way I am.
Joe Parr's research ties into what?
Joe Parr, basically, he experimented with model pyramids in his lab and discovered there's energy fields, like a bubble, that surrounds these model pyramids. And he was able to measure these energy fields by seeing how they attenuate or block off energy fields like radiation, radioactivity, electromagnetic radiation, etc. And he found out that pyramids have these energy fields that can block. So we know the field exists because it blocks these other electromagnetic radiation. So his work has to do with measuring this energy field and also finding out what causes these energy fields around these pyramids, what triggers them. And that's something known as the Great Annihilator in the center of our galaxy that we think is responsible for this. So, again, we talk about all kinds of relationships. Maybe, you know, again, if you want to talk a little bit about Joe's work now, I don't know how much time we have before the break.
Yeah, we'll probably do it at the top of the hour along with the phone calls and get into some of his work. And it was a little dependent on his gamma ray emitter, wasn't it?
Yes, very good point. In fact, I don't know how you figured that out, but I don't think I wrote that anywhere. But yes, because of him inventing that, that gave him the tools to study the pyramid. Well, you're doing your homework, George.
You have to. You have to. With someone like you, John. If you don't, you get caught. give me your website.
It's GizaPyramid.com, GizaPyramid.com. And you can email me, the director, if you have any questions or comments. I get a lot of email, but I got to be honest, I love email. I love hearing from people. I like hearing positive, negative suggestions. So please feel free to write to me. I try to answer as much as I can. I do read all my email. They can also order my book from Barnes & Noble on that site. I got a link they can just click on and order it directly. I'd love to get this book in every library in the country.
Well, you'll get enough emails to last you about 2 years. We'll be back with phone calls next. John, before calls, talk a little bit about Joe Parr's work. Was he related at all to Jack Parr, the entertainer?
Yeah, I always kid him about that. No.
Not at all, because there aren't a lot of Parrs out there.
You remember Jack Parr, huh?
Oh, sure.
Do you remember Jose Mellis?
I remember Milton Berle.
No, Jose Mellis was the band leader in the original Jack Parr show.
Was he? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I played in his band for a short period of time.
What did you play?
I was a drummer.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, I used to study from Ed Shaughnessy, who was the drummer on The Tonight Show.
Oh, that's great.
I just love music and I love jazz. So that's why when I first met Joe, I said, hey, you got to be, you know, related to Jack Parr. So I love that question.
Super. Anyway, Joe Parr did his research. He tied in his gamma ray emitter, at the center of the galaxy.
Right.
That NASA discovered many years ago. How did that correlate with his data?
Yeah, this is what, in terms of the most important discovery of Joe was, as I mentioned, you know, he found out all pyramids, whether they're small model pyramids or the Great Pyramid of Giza, has a bubble or orb or energy field surrounding it. And sometimes it's strong, sometimes it's weak, sometimes it disappears. But when it's strong, he could simulate it and strengthen it in a lab, it becomes a block in the shielding effect, and it blocks out all known radiation, like even electromagnetic radiation. Even gamma rays are the most potent, powerful energy fields in the universe. Now, what he tried to find out was what affects the field, because he noticed that, like, at the end of 1979 into 1980, the energy field started to disappear around the pyramids. Then several years later, it came back. And then it wasn't until, like, years later he discovered the answer. He found out that this energy field around the pyramids were directly related to what something astronomers had discovered at the center of our galaxy known as the Great Annihilator. And NASA discovered this in 1979 and with a weather balloon, later using a satellite. In the center of our galaxy, they called this thing a Great Annihilator. It's a gamma ray emitter. Remember, gamma rays are the most energetic rays, even more than X-rays. And actually, NASA thinks the extinction of the dinosaurs or whatever, you know, could have been due to a gamma ray burst somewhere in the galaxy. So these are really potent rays that could destroy life on Earth. Nobody knows what this gamma ray emitter is. Maybe it's a black hole, maybe two black holes circulating around each other, but it exists. NASA confirmed it, that there's this emitter. Now, the question is, the energy field, the gamma ray emitter, sometimes it's on and sometimes it's off. And it correlated exactly when the energy fields of the pyramids are on and off. When the gamma rays tend to increase from the center, the pyramid orb increases and blocks out fields much more stronger than when the field is off. So it's like this gamma ray emitter is controlled from the center of our galaxy, 25,000 light years away, is controlling the energy fields. Now, the other correlation Joe found, which really blew my mind, was people have always been wondering, why is the Great Pyramid built where it is? Some said it's the center of the Earth's land masses. But Joe calculated and found out that only at the 30-degree latitude would the Great Pyramid's base once a day point directly to the galactic center, like it's monitoring this pulse of energy. So now it leads to speculation. Why would an energy field around a pyramid be controlled by the galactic center? Is this some kind of device, the pyramid, to prevent extinction of life by forming a bubble or energy field around, you know, who knows, a location or around the Earth? It's interesting to speculate because it also appears between 2007 and 2012, the Earth is going to get more of a clear shot at the galactic center. There's not going to be all the space debris, which means gamma ray bursts would be less impeded. So, again, you wonder, was the purpose of the Great Pyramid, was it built by some advanced civilization, aliens, whoever, to protect the world or life from extinction? Interesting speculation, but Joe's observations are actually, you know, scientific. They're measured with the energy field, the NASA information. So the rest of it is kind of a speculation. Why would an energy field exist around this pyramid?
Hoagland would call it hyperdimensional physics, wouldn't he?
Well, yeah, basically that's it is. It's and Joe actually thinks the pyramid actually could move through hyperspace. And the other interesting thing, which, you know, again, don't have a lot of time to talk about, but, you know, the colony the collapse syndrome, you know, with the bees dying off. Joe wrote about this, and I did around 2003. It appears that in his lab, you know, where he's doing these experiments, a large bubble, about 100 foot or so, has formed around the experimental apparatus around his house. We don't know why. It's probably some kind of effect of the smaller bubble around the pyramids. But when bees fly into this bubble by accident, you know, just they will become disoriented and then die, just like what we've been observing in the colony collapse disorder. And this was years before anyone even talked about colony collapse disorder. And Joe has ran some oscilloscopes, frequency generators at the frequency that the bees vibrate their wings, which is 200 cycles per second, with the pyramid energy field, and found that humans become disoriented in this field. So I'm not saying the pyramids are causing the colony collapse disorder, but there may be some mechanism here to determine what is causing it, you know, whether it is cell phones or pathogens or mites or whatever, all the different theories of the colony collapse disorder. So, see, Joe Parr's research to me is very scientific, by the way, because other physicists have repeated his experiments. So you can take his schematics, build his stuff, and repeat it, and it's based on scientific data. Now, some of it that I threw in is our speculation about the purpose of it, but I think the potential for space travel, for stargates or whatever, is going to be dependent on Joe's research. I think he's going to go down in history as actually making some of the most profound scientific discoveries on pyramid research.
Okay, let's go.
I tried to do that real quick. I really need about an hour to come.
You need three. You need three. Let's go to the calls. They're all stacking up for you. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Okay. This is Owen from Roanoke Park.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to ask Dr. DeSalvo something. Have you ever heard of a Swedish engineer by the name of Olof Alexanderson?
No, I haven't.
Well, this man supposedly found out through the story of the Tibetans that had stories of raising stones and things, that through groups of various sounds, as in drums and trumpets, and the knowledge of various vibrations in those instruments' audio range, demonstrates that the vibrations in condensed sound field can nullify the power of gravitation. And he wrote, but he got interested in this because of the story of a man that went to Tibet and wrote a story about seeing this and actually supposedly, okay, made some film on it. But that was in 1939. This is more of a recent article, and he calls it implosion number 13. But what the Tibetans were able to do using these sounds was move stones and raise stones to the side of a cliff and use it in something they were building. I don't know how true this is, but I've read this story quite a few times in different venues.
No, I find it fascinating because I knew somebody who researched that type of Tibetan sounds, and I think there's some basis in it. The question is, how much had they developed it? Could they raise large stones or small stones?
Yeah, apparently they could, and they could also, they apparently had some problems with it. So when a stone split, they were able to drop that stone, pick up another stone, and send it in the direction that they wanted it to go.
Interesting. You know, if you have any articles or links on it, email them to me.
I'll email you the information that I have.
I believe that there is a basis to that. I really do. From just my. By the way, you know, I've been involved in certain types of Eastern meditation, and I am a firm believer. By the way, in the power of meditation, I believe everybody should meditate. But the Tibetans and some of the Eastern gurus and spiritual teachers had some power or insight into what you're talking about, and I do. Look, even in the Bible, right, the walls of Jericho fell. They marched around and blew the trumpets, you know? So, and I'm a drummer, so I do believe levitation through drums would work. Good question. Really good.
Next up, Brian in Cleveland, Ohio. You're on. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I got two questions.
Okay.
The one less important one is, in his book, Heaven's Mirror, the author, who I can't remember the name of, mentions a story in the pyramids. Something to do with the hieroglyphics. I was wondering if your guest knows where I can find something about that at. But the more important question is, the pyramids are based on Orion. Do the other places, Stonehenge, the Yucatan, etc., do they have constellations that they're correlated to?
Oh, man, good question. You know, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to really – I don't know the answer to the second question. I know there's correlations with solar and the moon, you know, and – I probably have read some, but no, I don't know. I bet there would be, though. I would think so because, you know, even like, you know, the Dogon tribes and all the different ancient cultures always, as far as astrology goes back to and the constellations, was an integral part of all ritual worship. So I would guess there is. I can't be specific because I just don't know. The first part, the only hieroglyphics I know in the pyramids were the ones discovered by Colonel Weiss, and they are debated. So it may be something else you're referring to. If you want to email me more specifics too, I'd be glad to look into it for you. But very good question. And I like I said, most of those ancient monuments are solar and lunar oriented, and I would suspect there would be constellations involved too. Yeah, excellent observation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you got it. Next up, it's your turn. Wildcard line, Ray, driving around in Arkansas.
Yeah, it's Ray on my way to Little Rock.
There you go.
And, I wondered if anybody had ever considered the fact that the reason they haven't found a capstone is that the capstone may have been a catalyst of some sort that actually activated whatever the pyramid was built to do. If the pyramid was some sort of a collector or generator of energy, perhaps the capstone was some sort of a crystalline catalyst that allowed it to do what it was built to do, and it basically was destroyed in the process of the pyramid operating in the way it was supposed to. And secondly...
Well, can I comment on that, Ray, before I forget? Then maybe you can ask your next question. I think that's excellent. I tend to agree with that first part of what you're saying, that it may have been the catalyst, like a crystal structure, something to activate the pyramid. And one possibility would be, like you said, it was destroyed. The other possibility is maybe it's hidden. And if we find it, we can activate the pyramid. So I'm sorry, what was your second question?
Well, my second question was that it also may be hard to figure out what the pyramid were originally intended to do if you consider that perhaps what we're seeing of the pyramid, as massive as it is, that perhaps what we have left here is the superstructure of something that was even larger. And just as in, I was saying with the capstone, it may have been consumed when the pyramid was activated. So the massive core of the pyramid is all we have left, and whatever the outer structure was consumed during its operation. So it would be hard to tell what the original purpose was because you don't have the entire edifice.
Yeah, that's a very smart observation. I'll tell you why. Another reason that could be is that some other researchers, like Dr. J.J. Hertek, a remote sensing expert, knows that there's incredible complexes below the Giza Plateau, and he believes there's even more under the Great Pyramid structures than above it. So that would maybe be one of the reasons, which you hit on it. Maybe there's just, you know, we've just seen the tip of the iceberg or part of it. So, Ray, excellent observation.
Well, that's all I really had. Appreciate your time, George. I appreciate your guest.
Absolutely.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. You too, Ray.
Thank you very much. Great calls here for you.
Oh, excellent, sure. Excellent.
Trucking along in South Carolina. Randy, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi, Randy.
Good evening, George. How are you guys?
Good, sir. Thank you.
Hi, Randy.
Okay, it's kind of more of a modern question, but you guys have a pyramid out there in Las Vegas. It's pretty big size, and I wonder if anybody ever did any research on that.
Oh, at the Luxor, you mean?
Yeah.
You know, we were talking about having a symposium there. We never got around to it. Yeah, that's a good question, because besides the Luxor, and like the Louvre, and there's other pyramids in Canada, all over the place. What an opportunity. Anybody, you could, you know, they're open, probably open to the public, or you could probably do some testing. I'm not aware of any. It's a really good question, really good possibility. Do you have any ideas or what you would suggest there?
I don't know. I just wonder, because there's so much research going on pyramids, and this one's such a public one right there that,
no, good observation, and that's why people build pyramid houses too. I think not only for the idea of enjoying the energy, maybe they probably plan on doing experiments. But that's a very interesting point, and it like opens up a whole area of possible studies. Maybe the people who designed these pyramids knew more than we thought. It wasn't just for the aesthetics of it, but they knew there was going to be some type of special forces produced. Excellent.
Yeah, I wonder. All right, thanks, guys. I appreciate
thank you.
It.
All right, thank you, too. What fascinates everybody about the pyramids, John?
Well, the most obvious thing is obviously the height. I always say that man looks up to God. That's why cathedrals are built high. That's why mountains, the Tower of Babel. I mean, Moses was given the Ten Commandments on a mountain. The Code of Hammurabi, that was given to King Hammurabi on a mountain. We look up into the sky. We get that sense of God. That is one possibility, that the highness, the loftiness of the pyramid brings our soul in contact with God. I think, too, the mystery. What is it? It's just such an unknown structure. You know, I usually like to conclude when I give a talk on the pyramid is that, you know, after spending several hours talking about it, I can tell you certain things. One is we don't know who built it. We don't know when it was built. We don't know how it was built. And we don't know what its main purpose is. I mean, for sure, you know, there's a lot of theories and speculations, but it's such a mystery. And when you think about all the time and money and dedication and years that people have put into the study of the Great Pyramid, there's something there that's mystifying everyone, George. So what exactly – I think, you know what? I think it's different for every individual, but it's that common denominator, the presence of something supernatural, something within them that it awakens.
I think so, too. Let's chat for just a little bit about where you can get your latest work, Decoding the Pyramids, and also, aren't you working on another book that has to do with angelic languages?
Yes, I am.
Tell me about it.
First of all, the book Decoding the Pyramids is published by Barnes and Noble, and there are links on my website and on yours. If people want to call, all they have to do is call 1-800-THE-BOOK. I don't think they're open now, though, but that's the order line for Barnes & Noble, 1-800-THE-BOOK. And like I mentioned, it's only $12.98. I suggest if you buy two copies, I think they give you free shipping for over $25 orders, three-day shipping if they still have that, and give a copy to your local library. It has over, you know, about almost 200 pages, hundreds of color photos and diagrams. It's a hardcover coffee table book. I don't know how they can sell it for $12.98, to be honest with you. Oh, and it's on the Father's Day table at all the Barnes & Noble stores.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I couldn't ask for better placement.
How'd you pull that off?
They did. I had no idea.
I
called the Barnes & Noble corporate, and I said, when is it coming out? And they said, we're going to hold it off because it's going to go on the Father's Day table. And I couldn't believe it. I was just so excited. And I went in there with my one of my sons to see it the first time. It was so exciting. But they're selling out really quick. I've been getting calls from people all over the country saying they can't get it. But they had copies online, which were gone, and now they have them back in their warehouses. So I'd suggest if you want a copy, get it soon, because they seem like they're making great Father's Day gifts. And people are telling me they're using them as graduation gifts. I guess it's, you know, kind of past that. So, George, I'm really excited. This has been, you know, a decade of dedication. Like I said, I feel I'm more of a compiler, not a researcher.
Well, you've worked hard, John. We'll be back. Let's take final phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're back with Dr. John DeSalvo. We're going to take your final questions here as we wrap up another very fast night. Deborah in Milwaukee, you're on the line with us. Hey, Deborah.
Hello, and hello, bro.
Hi.
You're there. I wanted to ask your guest if he's familiar with the pyramid texts that were found in the five pyramids from the 4th and 5th dynasty. That's one question I had.
I'm not an expert on them. Actually, I have a book on the Dead Sea Scrolls also coming out this year, and I talk a little bit about the pyramid texts. So, I'm no expert, but I am familiar with them.
And you mentioned these. I was kind of intrigued because in their language, which is believed to have really started in Asia, the wasp represents royalty. When ideas were too abstract to be literally pictured, they pictured the idea like a tadpole represented a thousand, royalty was a lion, et cetera, et cetera. So they further developed what came from Asia.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating, too, because, you know, besides the pyramid text, like the Book of the Dead, some ancient writers, actually as far back as the 1800s, have felt that the Great Pyramid was like the Book of the Dead or the pyramid text immortalized in stone, that there were similarities. If you go through, like, the Book of the Dead and the pyramid, and you can put these correlations, I mean, they're not sometimes real strong, but they're there. I don't know if you've done that, but it's fascinating to read the Book of the Dead having the inner structure of the pyramid in mind, you know? Very fascinating.
And the 24 consonants, it developed further to 24 consonants and moved to Greece then. So it's interesting.
It is.
I think
the study of ancient texts, like you mentioned, the pyramid texts and others, really open up what maybe the ancients knew and to go in and analyze. I wish I had those skills. I don't. I'm not an ancient language expert. I rely on others. But that has to be one of the most rewarding areas to study, to actually go in and read these languages as the original writers wrote them and try to see what higher meanings may have been attributed. But, yeah, I wish I knew more about those. I just know kind of pretty much the basics on the pyramid text, and I think I suggest there's some really good – Faulkner has a really good translation out there, and that's, you know, one people may want to look at. There are so many good ones, too.
Well, it's funny that the further one studies archaeology and ancient history, the Old Testament fits like a glove.
Yes, yeah. Like George mentioned, I have a new book coming out, The Seerist of Prevorce, which has to do with the angelic and language of the spirits. And a great part of tracing this original language of mankind called the primal wisdom, I use through ancient writings and especially the Bible. So if you know how to look for the codes and what the fact is from the mythology, I think it gives us an incredible map of what happened and searching for certain, ideas. Excellent,
Okay, thanks. Let's move next. Grant in Great Falls, Montana. First time caller.
Hello, George, Mr. DeSalvo. Hi.
Yes. Hello.
Great.
Hey, my question is, the Giza Plateau hasn't moved for 6, 10, 50,000 years because the north and south on the Great Pyramid is perfectly north and south. And I find it hard to believe, especially with the Great Rift going through the Red Sea, I find it hard to believe that that hasn't moved 1 millimeter.
Yeah, there is some, though, the Great Pyramid is not perfectly aligned true north. It's pretty close, but they think the shifting of the Earth's, the continents moving and different shifting that it could have been originally true north and it moved off a little. But, yeah, no, you're right. It couldn't be exact because of all the things that you mentioned.
Okay, very good. Thanks. Let's go to you, east of the Rockies, David in Chicago.
Hi, my name is David. I was reading back in the 80s about a prediction by Piazza Smythe, who made the first measurements of the inside of the pyramid, and I'm not sure what year he and his newspaper publisher friend in London published his prediction, but he said that this was a prediction relating to the year 1881 in which there would be this momentous happening, the likes of which the world had not seen since the coming of Jesus. And I was wondering if you know what that is. I have the answer myself, but I wanted to see if you know what the answer to that is, sir.
The only thing I think he could maybe be referring to was that there was a whole study known as pyramidology in the 1800s, early 1900s. I mean, there's still people that believe in it, but they looked at the pyramid as a timeline, and they used like an inch represented a year, and they moved down the passageway and showed certain biblical events correlated with certain places in the pyramid, like at the ascending passageway would be where the Exodus took place. And if you moved up to the Grand Gallery, that year turned out to be 33 AD, and it opens up. And then there was the second coming of Christ they predicted, but it obviously didn't happen because that was, in the 70s. But that's what you may be referring to. I have a section on that in my book on pyramidology, but I put it in there for historical reasons. Again, I don't think most, serious researchers consider that, as a serious study. But I think, does that sound like what you were referring to?
Probably does. International Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Hi, April.
Hi. I have a few quick questions. The first one would be, what is the most plausible way that the pyramids have been built? Would that be giant mammoth like a dinosaur thing or anti-gravity?
Yeah, I think we mentioned that before. I go with the anti-gravity or levitation if I had to choose one, but I don't rule out any of the others. I think it's interesting to consider them. But, we're talking about, again, a high precision, big structure, advanced machining. So that's my what I would go with is the levitation at this point.
All right. One more quick question.
Sure.
For George Norrie.
Mm-hmm.
Since giants and Bigfoot always come on the air. Could it be possible that Bigfoot may be a giant?
Yep, that's very possible indeed. Wildcard Line, John in Arizona. Welcome to Coast. Go ahead, John.
Good morning, George. Good morning, John.
Hey.
Good morning, John.
Hi. One quick question that maybe some listener would know. I was moving from east to west, went through Chicago and stayed over, and they actually showed it on the news in the hotel I was in. The guy was building a scale model of the Great Pyramid, and he was going to cover it in gold to the tune of $7.5 million, $1975. And
wow.
They showed the photos live of it being constructed. Wondered if it ever got done. And you really took the wind out of my sails when you mentioned Joe Parr. I was driving home. I was going to say, I want to tell you the coolest thing I ever heard about the pyramids.
Oh,
that was the gamma rays. And the way it was presented, he was more concerned about what was underneath the pyramid, which he believed would be another pyramid base-to-base spinning.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I'd say 80% of the email I get relating to pyramid research is about Joe Parr and his work, and he also did studies on ley lines, so I agree with you. It's fascinating stuff, you know?
It is. It's amazing.
And I appreciate you pointing it out, because my background is really science, but again, I'm open up to obviously all the mysteries. You could see probably all the things I've been into, but when I see a theory that has scientific backing, scientific method, scientific repeatability, I kind of say, you know, I think there's something here. And Joe has his work has all those markings to that.
Yeah.
I got to apologize. I couldn't go into as much detail as I would like. But, again, his work is on our website. It's in my book. It's all over the place now. I'm glad Joe's getting the recognition he finally deserves, by the way. So I appreciate that.
And thank you for your good work.
Thank you so much. Thank
you
for calling.
Okay. Travis in Queens, New York, thank you for calling. First time, huh?
Yes, my first time calling.
Okay, Travis, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. I was wanting to know about, like, the people with elongated heads, you know, the people that had – I wonder if that has something to do with, like, the, you know, the pyramids or anything like that, you know, those tribal people who made their heads almost shaped like a pyramid. Was that kind of giving them some kind of energy or something like that?
Ever come across that, John?
No, it's a good question. I mean, I'm familiar with the shape, like they call the cone heads, they would call them.
They stretch their heads.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I wonder, you know, does that mean their brains are larger? That they have a capacity to produce certain kinds of energies or receive things? You know, they're not just a biological phenomenon. Like we know, it was in some of the babies in China, they would put boards on the heads to make them elongated. But we're talking about possible, you know, alien or a different race of people that may have had heads like that. I think some fossils were found, if I'm not mistaken, too, that people are studying, archaeologists are studying, are these actual, you know, types of heads that evolved at one time, and do they have special attributes? Good question. See that to me, that's a whole other area of research. That's a whole other book somebody could write. Maybe that's something you'd get into, because fascinating, and I think it needs to be done, because there's a mystery that has not been explained adequately. So a very good observation.
Okay, very good. Thanks. Let's go to our wildcard line. Tom in West Virginia. Hey, Tom.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing great.
I've tried to get a hold of you on a lot of different subjects, but this is a pretty good one.
You got it. That's right.
Now,
thank you.
Okay, they say that the shape of the pyramid has energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember back in the 70s how they used to sell things and say that, like, if you put your razor blade under here, that it would make the razor blade sharp. Now,
right.
Would it have that? I'm just wondering, would it have that kind of energy or...
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something I didn't get to cover. The Ukrainian research did that. By the way, that was discovered back in the 30s by Carl Duvall, a Czech radio engineer. One of our researchers, Dr. Vladimir Krasnoholovits, who's a senior scientist at the Institute of Physics in Ukraine, did that. He put razor blades, different kinds of razor blades, under pyramids, and then used a scanning electron microscope to show that the razor blades under the pyramids actually sharpened.
Really?
So there was real science now, finally. And actually, in my book, I have the micrographs of his results. So I'm so glad you asked that question, because I didn't mention it. And again, another piece of scientific evidence that this energy field is real.
So you really think that the shape of that pyramid would help something like that?
Yes.
It almost sounds like magic.
No, it does. And see, that's you know, I'm glad, that's another good point you made, because in 1973, you know, Pat Flanagan's book called Pyramid Power, everyone referred to that.
I remember that.
Remember that? That was like mystical.
Hmm.
I current coined this term. We're moving from pyramid power to pyramid science. What we looked as magical is now factual, just as gravitation was magical. Now, you know, TV was magical. It's factual. But we are now actually measuring scientifically this energy field. I mean, we don't know it exactly what it is. We may be looking at it indirectly, if you know what I mean, by what it does. But
kind of like another dimension.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I thank you for those questions, because those are things I didn't get a chance to bring up, and you helped me fill in some of the gaps.
Well,
so
thank
really
you.
Can
I say something to George for a minute? Ask
sure.
A question?
Absolutely.
George, hey, I listen to you all the time. I want to ask you something. How would I get a copy of that song that you guys play as a bumper music, Some Velvet Morning? I would love to have that.
Oh, just it's available. You go to Amazon.com, and in the heading there, just put music, and then just type in Some Velvet Morning.
Right, I have done that, but I don't want the whole album. I just want the one song.
No, I can't give that to
you. Okay. All right, then. I'll let you go,
bud. Okay, my friend. Thanks. Let's go east of the Rockies. Gary in Jackson, Mississippi. Hello, Gary.
Hey, George.
Yes, sir.
Man, I sure enjoy your show, buddy.
Thanks, Gary.
Time. I just had a question for the doctor there. This pyramid thing's always fascinated me, and I'm an old guy and stuff, but the stones that they're made out of, how far away do they come from? I knew that years ago there was a group of university students that tried to float one down the Nile River, and it sunk their raft because they weigh over 3 tons. And me and I working to move heavy things, that's a question. Where do the stones, where does the rock, how far away did it come from?
Yeah, that's a good question.
That's a great question. They can, in some cases, those stones, those limestones, came from a long ways away, didn't they?
Yeah, there's certain quarries they feel they came from. I don't know if they can attribute all of them, and a lot of it is speculated it was floated down the Nile. But, you know, again, that would have been some feat. Very, very good observation. Again, the question is, the people that say that the whole pyramid was built from these quarries are assuming the standard, you know, wooden mallet, copper chisel, you know, floating on the Nile. And again, we're thinking that it has to be something beyond that to do it. It's possible the quarries are where they came from, but, you know, I don't think all this could have been done in a traditional manner, especially, you know, as we talked about the monumental size of the pyramid. Does that kind of, you know, explain that?
Yes, sir. I'm like you. I think they were set by extraterrestrials, because I've seen all of the scenarios of how they built them, where they piled sand up and rolled them up on logs, and then they got to remove all that sand, and they run it like a construction company, like 5,000 Egyptian slaves. I just ain't buying it all, but I'm like you. I think it was something else there.
Yeah, you know, again, I always got to say, I can't say how, when, why, or what purpose, but I think there's a lot of possibilities, and aliens is in the mix, that and you know, advanced civilizations, interdimensional travel, and, you know, maybe just some highly advanced civilization that we had one time on Earth, like Atlantis or whatever. So that's what makes it exciting, this whole area, because there's all these possibilities to be explored. So it's something that generations from now are going to be looking into, I think.
In some of these chambers, John, you couldn't put a razor blade between some of the fineness that they have there.
Exactly. You know, 1/50th of an inch, laser precision. I mean,
smooth.
It's amazing.
Weird. Yep. It really is. How'd you like to be the guy who had to work inside there?
Yeah. I mean, you know, to visualize how that could have been done is just amazing, you know?
Brian, Indianapolis. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was just, I've been listening to you for maybe the last year or so. I picked up a run going to Indianapolis.
Great. But, well, thanks,
Brian. Tonight kind of stuck out. I went to Cancun last summer. I went to the Mayan ruins.
Oh, yes.
Ah.
And it just was amazing how, like, everything, it was like the hall of something, where it echoed perfection 7 times. And I don't know if that would work with, like, the acoustics. I mean, because if you look at...
Oh, yeah.
Got a minute to go, but, you know, the resonance that he's talking about.
In the Great Pyramid, you have that. In the King's Chamber, you get resonance and all kinds of strange vibrations. So that seems like it's an integral part, you know?
I think so, too.
George, can I get a, before we run out of
yep,
time?
Yep, you got a minute, so go ahead.
I'd just like to thank some people because I'm so obligated to so many people for all this. And first of all, thank you for having me on again. I always enjoy coming on. And George, I wish I could do 3 hours of just call-ins. I enjoy them so much.
Wow, maybe we'll do that one day, too.
I would just love that. But I really want to thank, you know, because of this book and my new book coming out with Inner Traditions on the Seerist of Prevorst, my literary agent, David Alexander from the UK. I mean, he made all this possible, and the Barnes & Noble people, Peter Norton, director of co-editions, and Cynthia Barrett, senior editor, and my senior project editor, Mary Todd. I got to thank these people. They made a dream come true. This was my dream. This was 10 years of my life putting together a book to give everyone the credit they deserve, to summarize the research, and that could be important for students and teachers. And I am obligated and indebted to these people and also our board and all the people that contributed to my book. As I mentioned, that's not my work. They take the credit. I'm the compiler. I put it together. I do have a talent of putting things together and making them understandable.
You sure do. And you do a good job. John DeSalvo, thank you so much. For Kiris Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasour, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.